This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Timps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking about fear as a factor in our mental health with our guest, Claire Easton. And before we talk more about her, we'll get into a few stats. So we particularly wanted to cover fear at the moment because it seems something sort of endlessly linked and relevant to the pandemic. And now that we're so much further through, we are seeing a lot more stats coming out about just how much fear, anxiety, the pandemic are all interlinked. And to a degree, I think that understanding and that link can potentially present its own challenges as well, because sometimes people can see them as interchangeable, of someone experiencing, you know, anxiety that they need support with. And then some people may respond to that as, well, of course you're going to be anxious. You'll be fine when this is over. But that doesn't mean that you don't need support now necessarily. It's not necessarily true either. There's a lot of this experience which can be innately traumatic and cause anxiety in a longer term sense.
Absolutely. And I watched a documentary, actually, a Stacey Dooley BBC documentary. In fact, I think it was BBC. Last night, revisiting the psych ward, it's called. She'd been there, I think, a year or two ago. But it was just so interesting. Obviously, the staff and what they're having to go through is just unbelievable. And COVID has absolutely, obviously, impacted that in a huge way. But it really was a focus on the people that live with mental illness and experience poor mental health all the time. And COVID has obviously exaggerated it. But, you know, there's people that are going through so much anxiety and living with so many different mental illnesses that, you know, I think the fact that we're speaking so much more now about mental health is fantastic. And the pandemic has helped that in a strange way. But it's not to forget there's so many people that you can really take the pandemic out of the situation, and what was there before may have been highlighted a bit, but will still be there after, you know?
For sure. And we talked about that, I think, a lot at the beginning, how on one side, anxiety in particular was a condition that a lot of people said they felt more understood at the moment, because maybe it's that more people are feeling anxious or more people can understand why you would feel anxious currently. And that's kind of a double-edged thing, isn't it? Because that still feels quite conditional. So, of course, I hope that that level of understanding will continue.
Yeah.
And we've got some stats actually about just how common certain types of anxiety are even before the pandemic. So the National Institute of Clinical Excellence reports that social anxiety disorder is one of the most common anxiety disorders. Estimates of lifetime prevalence vary, but have been as high as 12%, with estimates for other anxiety disorders around 6% for generalized anxiety disorder, 5% for panic disorder, 7% for post-traumatic stress disorder, and 2% for obsessive-compulsive disorder. And I should say that is not all the types of anxiety, but it is interesting seeing them laid out in that way. And social anxiety disorder, that prevalence is even higher than I thought. And yet that is a stat from before the pandemic. And so you can't help but wonder where that is now. And you're absolutely right about, of course, so much of what we do is about bringing up the level of understanding, the level of conversation, so we can remove a lot of the stigma. And there's a really shocking stat here that I think illustrates that, where only about half of those with social anxiety disorder ever seek treatment. And for those that do, the average time between the onset of symptoms and getting the support is 15 to 20 years.
My goodness.
And you do think to yourself how much of that is the stigma and feeling that you can't speak up, or maybe a certain amount of social anxiety perhaps being normalized and being not taken seriously.
Yeah, I was really surprised, and it just hits home again how so much of what we take for granted day to day, just stepping out there or going to, you know, meet friends or going to work, even whatever, can really have an impact on people. And I think you're right. Not only, though, is it, I think, that the stigma, and we've spoken about self-stigma before, but not only the stigma in society, but the more we're speaking about mental health and trying to break down these stigmas, I think that also is helping people, not only from a, I know that there's something not right with me, or, you know, I'm struggling in a way, but because of a social stigma, I don't know what to do about it, but also not actually being able to understand it yourself. So the more we're talking and having these conversations, it's providing people with maybe in themselves the language and the understanding of what might be going on with me. So I think you're right, there is part stigma, but I think a lot of people also potentially, you know, suffer in silence, as the term goes, because of the fact that maybe they don't even know how to articulate or address what's going on for them, whether or not then even stigma would come into it for them. It's more of a lack of understanding.
For sure. And that's one of the things that really breaks my heart the most, to think of how many people have diagnosable mental health conditions, but because of maybe a lack of education or a lack mm-hmm. of conversations about particularly certain conditions are still hardly spoken about at all, that maybe they don't even think that. They think, oh, that I'm just bad at life, or I just struggle a lot, or I'm just a shit person, you know. And I know that at certain points when your mental health is bad, that can be part of it. Having that negative self-talk, that can be a big component. And so then to think that because the stigma is where it is, it kind of backs that up for people. It can be easier to believe these bad things about yourself. Yeah, and even sharing statistics like this that might challenge our expectations, that might bring things to the fore that we hadn't thought about. Like another one here is that social anxiety disorder has an average onset age of 13 years. And if you think, you know, 13 years, and then if you might wait 15 to 20 years to get the treatment, that chunk of your life, so much of your development into who you are is in those years, and the lifelong impact that can have. And also, not for nothing, if the average is 13 years, how young are some people experiencing this? How commonly are really young people experiencing it?
Yeah, it's, you know, heartbreaking, really. And actually, I think one in that documentary, it was interesting because they said they'd never seen so many people in their 40s and 50s come into the service since the pandemic. And potentially quite a lot of those people had already been experiencing poor mental health, but never really, it's been undiagnosed, as you said. So therefore, this has just exacerbated it, the pandemic, and now they're presenting a mental health service. And also, my uncle was rushed into hospital last week and they found a tumour. He's nearly 50, but really young and active 50. But he's led a life, Bobby, of, how can I say this? I guess it's in our blood maybe, but he's a bit of a nomad. He's travelled from place to place. He's not really settled. There's no tradition about him. You know, he's had some really tough experiences in his life. He's been through quite a lot. He's been in trouble with the police. He's had some addiction issues, and so he's had a real traumatic life. And it's interesting because I spoke to a family member the other day who said this is almost now the tip of the iceberg, that this is it now. We've got to address not only his physical health but his mental health. And there were severe signs of things not being right with him at 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years of age, but we're talking back in, you know, in the 70s and 60s and 70s, and it's just never been addressed at all. And he's lived with potentially an undiagnosed mental illness that has caused him to interact with life in a way that maybe others look at as, what's wrong with him? Why is he behaving like this? Can't he just settle down? You know, and so now there are all sorts of assessments going on. But for my family, it's really hard now at the moment because it's been a huge wake-up call, because people have tried to help him before and it's not been quite successful. But have, you know, we ever looked further into what might be going on? And when we talk about this 15 to 20 years of sometimes things being, you know, undiagnosed, especially when they're illnesses that potentially don't present in a way that maybe, like, you know, that completely hinder your day-to-day experience. So you seem to be functional, but just not on a path that is deemed the right one. And I think when we think about fear and anxiety and social anxiety and those kind of things that people can live through, really struggle with, we seem to miss that, and it really can become absolutely, you know, really severe. And also, if we don't address maybe some cultural barriers that exist in support and stigma, that can have an even, you know, more severe impact. But yeah, it's just really sad. It's just, you know, a lot going on at the moment, and it's just a shame that it's gotten to this. But, you know, maybe hopefully now it's time that these things can be addressed. But I guess that's the danger, isn't it? We know it's not black and white when it comes to mental illness.
For sure. That's what motivates so much of this, right? Feeling so personally connected to these issues and seeing stats that resonate so strongly to a lot of our personal experiences. And I'm so sorry about your uncle. And it makes me think about just how many people it takes a physical health problem for them to end up getting treatment for their mental health. And that has got to change. You know, I'm not saying that will ever be perfect, but at the moment, there's such a strong skew for it going that way round rather than the other way. And actually, as we know, these things are so in tandem. And I think the pandemic has highlighted a lot of that as well. You know, we've got a stat here from Anxiety UK. They found that almost half, so 49.6% of people in Britain, reported high levels of anxiety. And that was sharply elevated compared to the end of 2019, when they looked at it previously, which was a level of 21%, which is still massive. But when you think of that 49.6%, that's over 25 million people in the country that are experiencing high levels of anxiety. And I think from what I read about this, a big part of that is that the physical factors, like the restrictions, are making that worse, because we're not only having the increased fear around the pandemic. And if we think back to that point, how much stress and confusion and fear of around the future we were all having, there was so much we were in fear of. And yet we knew, compared to now, so little about this virus, about what could be done. Would vaccines even be possible? How long would the lockdown go on for? You know, almost nothing was known, right, compared to where we are now. And where's all that fear got to go? We're limited on our social interactions, so we couldn't go and, you know, talk to friends about it. We couldn't go and do a lot of the sport that's an outlet for people, you know. So a lot of that just get pushed down. And there was a lot of, you know, I don't want to burden people. We're all going through this. You remember, I was just glued to the news because that was my way of being like, if I just gather all the information, that'll make me feel better. That'll make me feel like we have some more control in this situation.
You were, weren't you? Glued. That's the right way to put it. Bobby was like glued. Bobby knew every stat. You were all over it. You knew what news readers you preferred, what journalists you preferred. Like, you had it all going on.
Yeah. And, you know, I look back at it now and I just think we were really pulling at scraps when you look at how little information there was. And so, you know, in one sense, it's good to be so much further forward, even though things aren't over yet. But, you know, many of these links, the physical and the mental, the life factors and our mental health, many of these links have never been clearer. And so it's good to see that a lot more understanding is coming from that. But I'm really glad to get to cover fear today, and particularly talk to Claire about her experience of social anxiety, because I think that's something where much of the impact won't be truly known until the rest of the restrictions lift, until we return to some kind of normality, and then find out, okay, how much of these feelings of social anxiety are not going to be temporary, are going to need more support for people.
Yeah, I totally agree. I also think on another point, when we think about social anxiety and connect it to the pandemic and before, that's one thing. But also when we think about re-entering the world, not even from a is it safe to do so point of view, but how am I perceived now re-entering the world? Because I may have lost my job, or I may have put a lot of weight on, or I may have lost a lot of weight, or I might have fallen out with a partner or my friendship group or whatever it might be that then have changed my life in this pandemic. So actually, and especially if you experience poor mental health from time to time and you've gotten comfortable being at home because it's almost, I guess, shielded you from having to face what's out there. There's a real anxiety around that as well, stepping back into the world. And also as a mum of two, and as a working mother where everything's now, the work that I do with clients and, you know, training and facilitating, everything's gone online. I actually look forward to getting back face-to-face because that's where I feel I'm at my best. But there's an anxiety, Bob, that I've started to experience about, shit, it's all coming back. I've got 50 million sports clubs that they're doing. We're all on different dates, but they're all a bit temporary. Some are on a Friday now. We've got no after-school club. So now my days finish at 3 o'clock, which is just very, very difficult for me with work. But I'm also juggling all these temporary things because everything is, like you said, still temporary. We're not fully back. And so I've got one club on a Friday because they can only have a certain amount of children playing basketball indoors. But then, you know, from June, we're going to go on back to a Wednesday and then we'll be out. Like, there's so much going on that I'm actually finding myself and my own mental health and my levels of anxiety really increasing because I'm actually worried about how I'm going to adapt and manage it all again, being back out there. When we think about fear, I guess, more just being back out into the world and managing that life that has been left behind for a year is also quite terrifying, actually.
I agree, and I think a lot of it we will have to find out, you know, firsthand as it goes. I went to a restaurant for the first time with a friend the other day, and I kind of nudged her forward to speak to the waiter on my behalf. And that's not like me. I'm normally someone that's very happy leading any conversation. But it was just, I think I had this awareness of, it's been this long since I even asked for a table that somehow in my head, I'm like, I don't quite know what to say anymore. What do we do? We still do small talk, still talk about the weather, or is that arbitrary compared to what we've all been through now? You know, this was kind of going in my head. And so, you know, it was absolutely fine. But there was part of me that wondered, like, will I feel comfortable sitting down in a restaurant again when we've been, you know, and this was outside even, but when we've been taught that even that is something that's not safe, how quickly will we be able to unpick some of these fears? And I think for many of us, we won't really find out until we are returning more to our normal routines. And we might find that some bits, like going back to a restaurant, I think I'd feel, you know, I felt fine going back to one since. But there may be other things where unpicking that fear is a bit trickier.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think I think to end on, you know, it may be a bit trickier is maybe, you know, the right attitude, because with my practitioner head on, we are extremely resilient and we will get through it and we just take each day as it comes. And as maybe, you know, on the other side, when we look at the staggered return, although it can cause some issues because we're not there, we are there, and all the anxieties that come with not quite knowing that a lot of people face, also come with, well, actually, we're taking our time back into it. And at the moment, if we can only sit outside, that's okay. And in a month, maybe we can start to edge inside. We haven't gone from nothing to everything. And I think maybe if we, you know, we can look at it in that way, and that hopefully can help reduce some of the fears, that we take it as it comes, we take each day at a time, we are resilient as a human race. I mean, look what we've all been through for a year. You know, there's definitely some messages of hope.
Oh, I agree. And that's why I'm so glad to be talking to our guest Claire today, because she brings in a lot of those hopeful messages. She's someone that's so known online in the mental health world for her blog and for her writing and for her previous book. And she really deals in extremes, I think, in quite a seamless way, that she talks about in the interview, a lot of her anxiety, where she has thought she's dying on many occasions, where she still has panic attacks now, but she's found ways to manage so much of that, to get the support and to find the hope and the humour in it. You know, even the book is called Fuck, I Think I'm Dying. which, you know, I can relate to as someone who I don't think I have a huge amount of experience speaking without swearing in my language. And so we connected on that point. But, you know, sometimes you have to deal in these extremes and be honest about it. And maybe extreme language matches a lot of the extreme experiences we all have. And yeah, she brings the hope and the humour in around fear, around ways that you can navigate it. There are ways to overcome it. And in doing so, you can find that some parts of it don't make so much sense. And humour perhaps is a way of owning that and really belittling the fear. So yeah, wonderful guest to chat to. So with all that said, let's get into an episode about fear. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hello, my name's Claire Easton. I'm an author, blogger, advocate, and campaigner for mental health. My earliest memory of having anxiety was probably around about the age of 8. It didn't seem unusual to me at the time, but now I recognise the symptoms. Family parties in particular were an absolute nightmare for me, in the sense that I would arrive, be completely overwhelmed by the adults because I'm a child and they're interested in me. So I would go completely mute, even with prompting from parents, like, well, tell them about what you did this week or anything, what you've been doing at school, what you've been doing with your friends. And I couldn't. I was like a rabbit in the headlights. So I spent most of the time either hiding where the coats were, like one of the cupboards things, or in the kitchen with my grandma, who would just get more and more drunk and smoke cigarettes and slag off the rest of the family. Those were my safety areas. And as an adult, I recognised that those were key symptoms of anxiety. But as I say, at the time, I just thought it was just a quirk of my personality.
Right, which I think happens a lot. I was the same. I spent many years thinking I was a lonely person because I didn't know I was a person with depression. I can see what you mean, and those environments can be so stressful. Even now as an adult, you know, going into a room of other adults, I can still have imposter syndrome sometimes with that and be like, I'm not real human yet. I'm still figuring this out.
Absolutely. And to an extent, it feels like a performance to me because my friends know that I don't start conversations necessarily by how are you. I will say, oh God, and then I'll start with something that's happened to me that morning, or I'll ask them if they've watched something, or I'll ask them something like, who's your favorite superhero? I don't know. That feels more natural to me than going into, like you say, it feels like pretending to be an adult. Like, there's nothing worse for me than going to a party and somebody says, what do you do for a living? Because I'm like, I don't know. I'm 34 and I'm pretending to be an adult. Like, I've no idea. And I just freeze.
Yeah, and it's also weird because there's always somebody that you ask them what they do and they give you some kind of cryptic job title. And then by comparison, if you say writer, then that sounds too simple. It's like, no, you need this fancy thing that doesn't make sense. And actually, to me, it's always made more sense to say what you actually do rather than what your job title is. So I relate to that. But also, you know, being a child and having adults have a lot of interest in you and you not understanding why can be quite stressful. Mm-hmm. And just because they all seem to ask the same questions doesn't necessarily make that easier.
Yeah, it's true. And I learned from an early age by default because of this, that you need to have not necessarily a gimmick, but you need to have a story. I almost, like a therapist of mine used to say, she can tell when I'm nervous because I turn into comedy Claire. I'll tell a funny story, or I'll take the piss out of myself, or I'll think of some kind of anecdote that we can both focus on rather than them looking at me and seeing me.
Yeah. And I think people do that a lot. It's quite a common avoidance. And yet when we rely on it too much, it can separate ourselves from ourselves, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. It puts you in such a state of high alert because you know that when this story finishes, then what? What's the follow-up question? Like, because I don't know. So I'm telling this whatever it is story and then they might respond and I'm not listening to them because all I'm thinking is like, oh my God, think of something else to say. And, you know, it becomes this kind of exhausting cycle of anxiety, in a word.
And when you look back with the knowledge you have now and through much of the counselling you've had, what other kind of things are you able to identify that were fears around your childhood?
Oh, you think about that. Well, when I was at secondary school was definitely where they were amplified, those kind of problems, I think, which is really common for teenagers. You know, you, on top of everything, you're going through puberty, which is just great. You know, academic pressures and stuff. And then all of a sudden, you remember that, oh, I've got all that shit from when I was a child is still here as well. And for example, if anybody said my name, particularly teachers in class, you know, they would say, Claire, I still feel it now. That would be the same trigger for when adults at parties would say my name and ask me something. I can't remember. You know, I was in set one for most things and I couldn't answer any, like, the most basic question. I wouldn't even be able to tell you my name. And that was kind of just put down to excessive shyness and blushing. That was the bane of my life. I literally used to turn the colour of, like, an angry tomato for no reason. Just bright red. And then as soon as you do that, people want to know why you're going red. And my life is lots of little bits of the puzzle in that sense. It took me decades to figure out what was going on. Because you're just so desperately trying to get by that, like, I don't even want to think about this for a second because it might be even worse than I think it is.
Yeah, and so I can see mm-hmm. how when you'd had enough of these experiences where people called your name and then followed it up with some question that stressed you out, that became mm-hmm. linked. And so intrinsically you hear your name, it becomes a word that preempts failure.
Oh, that's another trigger of mine, failure.
Oh.
100%. Again, I only just realised this in the last sort of 5-6 years that, like most people with anxiety, I was a perfectionist. I became a perfectionist in my work and I could control that. Mm-hmm. Like that. I understand how academics work. I understand how this works. No problem. Social situations, you can't control because you don't know what you're going to get asked. You don't know what's going to happen. There's so much that could go wrong. So I would have a social interaction, assess it afterwards, and then decide whether or not I'd passed or failed. That didn't seem unusual to me. Like, I used to actually, like, brainstorm conversation points, and this is so embarrassing talking about it now because it's like, Jesus. But I was just like, you best have these backups in case your mind goes blank and you can't think of anything to say. MSN, sorry to segue here, completely fine on MSN. MSN Messenger saved my life, which makes sense being a writer now as my career. I just express myself better in writing than I do in person. Mm-hmm. In person, there was just too many variables that I couldn't really contemplate.
Yeah, but certainly for me, and I think this is partly linked to dyslexia, the perfectionism I have around writing is like a fear of being found out, you know, a bit of imposter syndrome stuff, but also mm-hmm. a fear of the judgment, I guess, you know, and maybe so many times coming back with work that was graded okay, but was full of like red marks, because even now I still can hardly spell. And so do you still feel that kind of pressure to be perfect with your writing? So even though, like, in a social situation that feels harder, it sounds like maybe the writing is still difficult. You just get to redraft.
That's really interesting. Yeah. Just to another point, I really think we should do away with red when it comes to corrections.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so damaging. Like, you get work back as a child and it's bleeding. We should change it. I don't know what colour to, but I just don't like the red. With the writing, I think when I first started, so I've been writing it for 18 months. And at first, when it came back like that, it's embarrassing and you feel stupid. You think somebody has read this and found me wanting and they've realize they've made a huge mistake. I'm gonna have to give them money back. I'm gonna lose my house. Like, this is how things spiral, all for some bloody red mark on your page. But it's actually been an amazing learning curve for me because I've been able to get comfortable with being edited, with being corrected, and realize that it is not personal. It's somebody trying to help your work be better, be stronger. And they've taken something that you've done and they've built on it, and they might spot things. And, like, most writers will tell you that, you know, first drafts are always shit. They just are, because it's almost like it's the start, it's the skeleton, you build on something. So maybe it's built in that area, but I'd kind of love to have someone with me during all social interactions and just say, so we're just going to go over this now, and this is what you can do next time. I'd like, okay.
A strategist, but just for conversations. I quite like that idea. I feel like that's a job I'd be good at.
You'd be great. You've got such a lovely voice for it as well. Like, I just thought, okay, so Bobby, you tell me what you think we should do differently next time.
Oh, thank you. It is funny. I think it's this weird kind of like bias that we have, that something about the way I speak, because I sound sure, people assume I am. And
yeah,
it's very handy. Sort of like pretending you revised. I'm very convincing until I get to the exam. So now that I'm an adult and I'm not doing exams, works well.
Look, really, really soothing. It's very steadying, so thank you.
You're welcome. Never been thanked for it before. But okay, so here's a thing. We can brainstorm together now and try it out. So one of the ways that I sometimes describe anxiety to people and the way that it can infect so much of your life is that because you have this narrative in your mind of doom and that the worst is going to happen, it can, at times when your anxiety is particularly bad or you're struggling with it most, bias you towards negative outside in the world. So you maybe see that red mark and you think, ah, that's confirmation. I'm not a real writer, or I have just like somehow got into this and I don't really belong. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I mean, you're just listing all my insecurities there, dude.
So how did the book help with that?
Oh, I think it's because it's slow. You know, it's like with therapy in a sense, you know, you don't get all the answers in the first session. You kind of have to grow with it. And the longer I was writing the book and the more I was doing it, I grew in confidence and I really had to accept that this was good. But I mean, it really hit me when I was doing the audiobook. Like, I recorded the audiobook about a month ago and I had never read the thing from start to finish, because you just don't, you do chapters. So from start to finish, I was reading it and for a second I forgot it was me. Mm. And I was like, oh shit, I think this is actually all right. Which was a good feeling. It definitely, with me, it helps to build foundations. You know, if I'm going to learn something for real, you have to go through the process and you have to go through all the emotions and you come to the conclusion yourself. Nobody can tell you. No one can give you that reassurance that you crave. It's impossible. Only you can give yourself that, which is so annoying, because if somebody could just tell me that everything's going to be all right and I believe them, it would save a lot of energy.
Yeah, but I guess maybe that's part of the book is called Fuck, I Think I'm Dying. When that's the starting point in your mind, when you're unpicking back from then, it just takes so many layers. And I think as you work on it, then you can bring people into the process. So it's like as your confidence grows, then you're maybe more likely to believe people when they say your work is good.
Yeah, like my editor gave me an amazing, probably one of the best compliments of my life. I can't remember it word for word now, but she wrote that it's, you know, it's one of the books that had changed her life, and I'd articulated it in a way that categorised her experience. And she'd been looking for a way to put panic attacks into anecdotes and terminology that everybody could understand, that was human and sometimes a little bit funny. And she said she'd found it mate. So this is a person I massively respect. She's amazing. So that kind of hit home. Wow. If you're not going to listen to this, then what are you going to listen to? That was amazing.
That's so brilliant, because it is something that can be so difficult to fathom if you've not experienced a panic attack. You can read all the descriptions of them and the kind of symptoms, and maybe you can relate to elements of it. But it's like many things in mental health, unless you've experienced it firsthand, it can be hard to contemplate how all-encompassing that can be.
Absolutely. What I find interesting is people are quite willing, who have not experienced a mental health condition, to give their opinion on it, which I find really bizarre, because I've never had arthritis, for example, but I wouldn't hazard a guess as to how it makes people feel. And that's something I try and address in the book, really. I think maybe just try and be a little bit kinder and listen when people are trying to, because it is hard to articulate what's going on in your head, because sometimes, you know, you haven't got to that point yourself. It took me a long time to understand what was going on. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
And do you think part of that is because you can't see many of the symptoms then, that people feel it's a lot more subjective? It is, you know, that you can be genuinely struggling and they might see that as more a matter of perspective?
Absolutely. I don't think they mean it maliciously, but some people are just determined to point out that something that's a genuinely diagnosable condition and devastating to you is something that we all experience. Like, I get a lot of, everybody gets nervous before meetings, Claire. Now, everybody gets stressed out about things sometimes, and I just want to scream like, yeah, but do you feel like slapping your hand in a drawer every time you make a mistake, Susan? No? Well, fuck off then. You know, I kind of like, don't try and hazard a guess on my experience. It's not something that can be solved with positive thinking or having a better attitude. Like, trust me, I've tried.
Yeah,
I'm doing the best that I can.
The more I discuss things like this in the podcast, actually, the more I start to be suspicious of where some of that comes from. When people are really strongly keen to deny someone else's experience, I think that strength of feeling may often come from experience they're trying to push down, that you're articulating something they can relate to. And they're like, oh, but I explained that away in myself. And so I'm going to try and explain it away in you.
That's so interesting. A friend of mine who writes about suicide and campaigns on suicide awareness said something similar about they're afraid they can't go there. That like it may have something they've experienced, or it may have been somebody they loved, but it's too frightening and it's too close to home. So it's almost like we can put that in a nice little safe box by saying this statement or this speech or denying it in general. It's quite interesting.
And sometimes a lack of understanding can lead to all kinds of weird assumptions as well. I think there are a lot of people that, whilst they might not admit it, them not understanding mental illness well enough can lead people to think it's contagious. You know, that if we talk absolutely. About suicide, that'll somehow catch.
Yeah, absolutely. Or that there's an anxiety epidemic when it's actually more that, you know, people are talking about it more, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah, also not to mention the world we're living in. I feel I'm more understanding of it. Not that I wasn't, but as a condition that I've not experienced firsthand, I struggle to see how somebody couldn't understand being anxious, particularly in this time.
Yeah, a friend of mine who has never really experienced like diagnosable anxiety. So this is my thing. I think, well, mental health is a spectrum. Mm-hmm. You will all go through periods in life when we feel depressed. It doesn't mean you have depression. We can all go through periods when we feel anxious. It doesn't mean you have anxiety. I think it's the diagnosis people are more afraid of. It would be really bizarre to say, oh God, no, I've never had a cold. No, never. What? You know, we'll have it multiple times in life, but you know, you learn how to manage it and you get better. So that's one thing. But my friend said during the first lockdown, I'm afraid all the time. I'm so frightened all the time. I realized I can't control everything. I can't stop anything bad from happening. And I can't stop thinking about it. And, you know, it must be absolutely exhausting for you. I'm like, that's actually quite a good explanation, well, definition in parts of anxiety. Like, I'm afraid all the time.
You've reminded me of one of the weirdest ironies, actually, of mental health stigma, that it often is the same people that would try and explain away your experience or dumb it down are the same ones that are terrified of having a diagnosis themselves. So on one hand, they think of it as this massive, scary thing that means there's something inherently wrong or bad about you. And then at the same time, they also want to downplay that experience. So it's like, it's just so strange when you hold some of these stigmas up next to each other and you think, how does this make any sense? And it doesn't, ultimately. You know, it comes from a lack of knowledge. And, you know, what you've described there, talking to your friend, so often that's all it takes, is just listening to her as you did. It was an explanation you'd not thought of before, and you heard it out and you took it on board.
Absolutely. And I think you're spot on. It's a lack of education, a lack of awareness, in that when I first started blogging, the reason I did it in many ways was because I didn't understand there's a lot of medical jargon, or there was in 2012 when I was diagnosed, that I didn't understand. You know, like serotonin, cortisol, SSRI medication. There's so much stuff that I'm like, I don't understand any of this. And that makes it even more terrifying. So I started trying to kind of decode it and just put it in language that everybody can understand. And that's how we move on, education and understanding.
And what kind of impact did that have on you?
Oh, great. I mean, it was infuriating for my doctor, because he used to turn up and like with a notepad. And can you just explain what that means? And sometimes they didn't know. Like, I knew it. You know, like a certain compact. I'm like, you don't know either. You're just repeating this shit to me. I really think that knowledge is power. It sounds really cheesy, but it is. Once you understand something, it's not scary. Another thing that's quite crass, so apologies, but if nobody explained to you, a girl, what her period is, and you pulled your knickers down one day and there's blood everywhere, you'd think you were dying.
Mm.
But once you understand what something is, it just takes so much of that fear away.
Yeah, and it's incredible that it still goes on where girls don't have that explained to them. And other things that are common, like only the other day I was reading one of Sally Rooney's books and the main character has endometriosis in it. And
I know which one it is, but Conversation with Friends.
That's the one.
So yeah. Good. So good.
And I didn't realise that 1 in 10 women experience that. Like, that's a stat I just never heard. And I'm a man, so that possibly that's part of the reason. But, you know, I spoke to my flatmate and she was like, no, women don't get taught that either. So 1 in 10 women can be out there and there's something life-changing happening inside them and they've never been educated about it. It's horrific.
It's so true. I mean, I wasn't going to talk about this, but there you go. I was diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome,
mm-hmm.
and I'm 34. it was only found in a routine check at a private clinic, and my GP didn't clock it. So 34. And there's so much now that makes sense, like my hair falling out, bad skin, weight gain, that unfortunately was attributed to anxiety, because once you get a diagnosis of anxiety and it's on your medical records, I found personally that people tend to, I don't know, I don't want to tarnish everybody with the same brush because it's not this way, but there's more inclined to say it's anxiety. Everything is anxiety. That's the explanation.
Yeah, some people use it as that's the end of the story. I think that's the part that offends me most. I'm like, okay, so you think it's because of this. Now what? You know, come to me with the suspicion and the solution, please.
Yeah, my hair's falling out. What? It's just anxiety. Like, okay, is there anything else we can do?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's one of the trickiest examples you can think of, right? Because what happens? Your hair's falling out and you will feel anxious about that. So then to be told it's because of your anxiety, that must have been terrifying.
You know, at this point in the game, whatever, it just is more frustrating because in many respects, I know more than my doctor, which sounds so pig-headed. And I don't mean it to. It's just because I've been studying this obsessively for the last 7 years. And, you know, a GP in particular has 10 minutes and has to diagnose everything under the sun. So it's more frustrating to me at this point. I'm like, oh God, can we not dive a bit deeper? Can we not, like, no. It's just one of the reasons why I became an ambassador for the charity MQ, which is a research charity, is for that reason. You know, we should be doing more research into mental illness. There should be, this shouldn't be as good as it gets. There should, you know, be more to the conversation.
Yeah, and I think it's one of these tricky things because, like we've mentioned, there's such a lack of education still. Obviously, we're doing what we can in terms of work on that. But for the adult population, we didn't go through having mental health education in schools. There's also lack of understanding on what causes many mental health conditions or elements of them. And so the more you learn about this, the more you realise what's left in the middle. The main thing that can draw these things together is kindness and understanding. And sometimes that sounds too simple, and we can be cynical of that because we'd love to have a magic pill. You know, if happy pills, as they're sometimes called in the media, if they really existed, oh, I would be signing right up. But it's a very complicated thing, and the, you know, MQ are doing brilliant work trying to figure a lot of this out. But in the meantime, there is such power in doing what research you can so that you can at least try and understand your experience, what kind of patterns you have in your symptoms, what kind of things help for you, medical or personal. And so what's that process been like then?
Ultimately, what it's come down to with me, the most useful thing that I've learned, because I love what you're saying about kindness and compassion, because a lot of what I believe in is treat your brain with the same respect as you do your body.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the most important thing I've learned is patience and just wait. I even have it tattooed on my wrist to remind me, because when something like anxiety hits or panic, you want to get rid of it like that. It's unpleasant. It's frightening. You want it to go immediately. But actually, you know, if you had a headache or if you had a cold, you just go, you go and lie down, you relax. You give yourself the space to feel poorly and wait for it to pass. You wouldn't push yourself on. You wouldn't try and pretend you're okay. You know, I really believe in therapy. I think medication can be beneficial. Exercise, all that stuff is fantastic. But personally, the most important thing I've learned is wait and rest. Mm-hmm.
I very much agree with that. We're in a time now where we are at home more. We are in proximity to our bed more. And yet sometimes these answers can seem almost too simple. You know,
yeah,
we get
absolutely
sort of suspicious of them.
Yeah, when I was first diagnosed, I was infuriated when this lovely health worker, nurse, tried to talk to me about diet. Like, are you fucking kidding me? I don't want to eat an apple a day. I want pills. I want drugs. I want anything that's going to make this go away. And, oh, that's another thing that it can seem so simple and irritating. But changing my diet up has been a huge help. So simple, but it's having the patience, giving yourself that time to work out what works for you.
Yeah, well, it's odd actually that we've never really talked about patients that I can remember in the interviews. And I wonder if part of that is the self-stigma, that even though we understand that you can put on a mask and try and muffle your symptoms and pretend you're coping better than you can. And that's partly because of the stigma. We are better at understanding that in ourselves at times than in others. And so we see everyone else's masks and think that's honest, and yet we understand ours isn't. And maybe that's part of why I don't hear a lot of people talking about patience in recovery and waiting it out, because it can feel like some kind of failure, like I should have better answers for this, or other people seem to be progressing faster than me. And are they?
If you would have spoke to me, you know, 2-3 years ago, I would have been reaching, being proactive. You know, exercise is the key. It's being proactive in finding, like, find your triggers and find some kind of routine, do the same routine every day, be active, make sure you're doing positive things. And I do believe that to an extent, but I think it's all relative and dependent on the person. But the idea of going for a run, like, I do like HIIT exercises in the gym and stuff, fine, but the idea of going for a jog, you know, like, oh, I'm just going to do a 10k, is the fucking worst thing in the world to me. That doesn't help. What helps me, which doesn't seem quite as good, is I like sleep. I need more sleep than the average person, and I've accepted this, and I've really had to accept that it's not lazy. Going to bed at 9 p.m., not every night, you know, I do stay up till 10 sometimes. You know, going to bed at like 9 is fine.
No, that's...
It's not all the time, but... Yeah, and some napping. Oh my God, on a Sunday afternoon, I just love an hour nap. It's great. It's just so like cozy, dreamy, you know. I think because of anxiety, I use up more energy than the average person. And even social interaction, to an extent, takes more from me than the average person, perhaps. Rather than beating myself up about that, I'll be like, oh, well, okay, I'll go and sit on the couch and read for, you know, for half an hour and just calm down a bit.
Yeah, and I love that. And it's interesting, though, even with that, you judge yourself a bit. You know, you compared it of like, oh, this bit of self-care that I do isn't maybe as good as some other people's, but it's the stuff that works for you. Like, that's why it's good.
Yeah, I know. It just doesn't sound quite as good as like, I'm going to do half a marathon on Saturday. And I'm like, I'm going to stay on the couch and watch The Musketeers.
But you know what? I've got a similar learning that I had to go through on this that really helped in changing my perspective. And that was realizing that there's very little about my mental health I can solve. I'm using that word with air quotes, in a day. That so much of me beating myself up on my worst days was this expectation that I should be able to fix it on the same day that I'm bad. And this is, I think, part of the reason why we can make our own conditions worse at times by judging ourselves across impossible standards, but also why some of these solutions can seem too simple. And then maybe we do go for a run, or maybe we do have a nap and we don't feel that much better. And we think, oh, fuck, this clearly doesn't work. Tried it once, never mind. But it's the application again and again, you know, in the same way, like you said, with nutrition, in the same way therapy can feel worse before it feels better.
Oh, 100%. It's bizarre, isn't it? But I have to so long that we still think that what's needed is more punishment, more criticism. If you just belittle yourself enough, you'll find the answer. When it's like, it's bizarre that being happy all the time is the ultimate goal, which is not realistic, is it? If we were happy all the time, it's just not a feasible quest. So I don't know why that's even me sometimes, like, God, I don't feel as good as I did yesterday. And it's sort of like, why are we focusing on this? Why is this a failure? It just happens.
It is so strange when you hold this behavior that can be so automated out and take a look at it and you think, imagine if I did that to somebody else. Imagine if every time somebody else felt bad, my reaction to that was to make them feel worse and then ask them why they're not happy.
Yeah. Well, you're not happy as you were 2 days ago. What a failure. No, you would never do that to somebody else.
And so in this time where we are at home with our own thoughts more, and we are seeing a lot of things that can bring out fear in us in the news, what kind of things would you recommend if somebody is experiencing more fear than normal and that's affecting their mental health?
It's difficult at the moment because there's an absolute cause why we're all experiencing more fear. There it is. There's the problem. But we've lived in this state of uncertainty for so long that it's as exhausting as it is overwhelming. We're getting, you know, hopefully there's light at the end of the tunnel now. We'll see. Just talk to somebody about it. Get it out of the head and onto paper. You know, you can write about it or talk to someone. what I always say to people when they ask me, how do I know if I have a mental health problem? And I say, well, you know you, as simple as that is. You know you better than anyone. And if you are noticing that, you know, certain symptoms such as these certain thoughts that circulate all the time, doesn't matter how often you try and rationalize them, they keep coming back. You can't get rid of them. You know, you've got disruptions in your sleep, your eating habits have changed, you can't relax, you're wired, you're more emotional, there's so many symptoms. It might be time to have a chat with your doctor. Think of it in terms of, you know, you wouldn't know a cough. 4 weeks of having a cough, you'd probably go and call the doctor about it. It's the same thing. It's so tempting to just ignore it and think, well, I'll be right. Even if the doctor, you talk to the doctor and they say, well, you know, I don't think we need to do anything present, that's okay too. And if you're really concerned about telling a doctor, I know I've had people in the past worry about it going on the medical records, which is really sad. You can ring the Samaritans. They're open 24 hours, it's 365 days a year, and you can just talk to somebody impartial. Just tell them about it. Is that really simple? Or that's really, really simple to an overcomplicated problem. But
no, I agree with that. I think there is no easy answer, right? You know, I would love the answer to be you come on here and say, oh, actually, I found something that fixes COVID and we're all going to do that. So everyone just needs to touch their toes and we're sorted. You know, I would love you to bring that answer, but I know that that is unrealistic. So in lieu of something like that, you know, this is what we have. We follow the measures, we get our vaccines. And in terms of fear, we do our best to understand that it may not go away anytime soon, but there are ways to live with it. There are ways we can get support. And sometimes it is as simple as tell somebody else about it. And particularly at the moment, they'll probably be like, yeah, me too.
Yeah. Do you know what? You just reminded me of something else I write about in my book is, I call it the oblivion complex, right? With something like COVID, which is so massive and beyond the dark control, there's nothing we can do about it. I was on, have you ever, you know, Alton Towers theme park? Mm-hmm. Right, there's a ride there called the Oblivion. I don't even know about it. It's literally, all it is you go, it's a vertical drop. That's it. You're like in a lay down, like you just face this tunnel and it's a vertical drop. It's horrendous.
Yes, I've seen friends go on it. I've heard the screams and I've decided never.
Well, 17-year-old Claire was foolish enough to go with friends, and there was this boy who she fancied who was going on it. So I'm like, I best go on this because I never live it down. Right, fine, I'll get on it. Do you know what? Looking back now, it's probably one of the earliest panic attacks I've ever had. But I remember getting into this thing, and as soon as it set off, this strange calm came over me because I suddenly realised it doesn't matter what I do. It doesn't matter if I'm frightened, if I'm happy. Like, nothing is going to stop this thing from completing the track. And it's my job to wait it out and make myself as comfortable as I can. And I think COVID is quite similar to the oblivion. Not like that, but you know what I mean? The theory behind it is, you know, we follow the rules, we keep each other safe, we get our vaccines, we do what we can, but ultimately it's not up to you to control this or try and stop it. You know, it's up to you to try and make yourself as comfortable as you can.
I think that's a great point, because I remember, particularly in the early days, it felt like at times there was a pressure that we all have to be constantly devastated, that we've all got to be, right?
That we've all got... I like that, constantly devastated.
It's true though, isn't it? There was this pressure that we have to, yeah, be appropriately and consistently devastated by the situation. And if we aren't, then we're somehow being dismissive of other people's experience, or, you know, someone needs to shout more stats at us because we clearly don't understand how bad it is yet. And I definitely fell trapped to that for a long time. And a big part of overcoming it was the privilege of having a podcast and having the responsibility to try and find something proactive to do with all this information, because otherwise it would have been far too tempting to go along with that and think, yeah, I should be feeling like shit. This is entirely appropriate. But just because it is in many ways doesn't mean it's our only option. And so sometimes finding those small bits of joy is what we have. You know, we're recording this on the 12th of April and I went for a walk earlier. I have no interest in going to the shops personally. I'm happy to stay away for a little bit longer. But it was lovely to see other people, you know, sitting outside having food and just be like, oh, that's so weird. You know, so long has passed and it's so weird to see, but it sort of warms your heart So that's something I've really tried to practice through this, is finding those small joys, really trying to cling on to them. Because at times it can feel like people want us to cling on to the pain. And like you say, when it's not something that's an easy fix, I don't know how productive that is.
Totally agree. And I'd also add to the small moments of joy, is that's why humour has been such a huge part of the way I manage my mental illness. You know, and if I take the piss out of it or find a moment that is funny and can lighten my mood just a little bit, it changes up my day and it just makes things easier for me anyway.
Yeah, a lot of it is ridiculous if you want to look at it in a certain light. We are adults who have been under some form of curfew for a year, like naughty kids, lest we give other people cooties. Like, there is a version of it where you're like, this is really surreal, and there can be humour even in this dark stuff. In the same way, you know, I like to try and find humour in stigma. It makes no sense. People try and stigmatise and call us mad, and I think the stigma is mad. I think they're the ones that have a very strange relationship with reality.
Yeah. You have to, what, anything in particular? I feel like I want you to tell me a joke now, which is like the worst kind of pressure to put on. Tell me a joke! One of the things I take the piss out of is when people say, all right, you just need to calm down. I'm like, you do realise that's the equivalent of telling somebody who's vomiting to stop vomiting, right? Just what you need to do is stop being sick. What?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. It's stuff like that.
Get a sword, just cut your arm off, you know? Simple.
Yeah, it'll give you a different problem to worry about. And it is fun to think that some people can maintain a world in their head where it is that simple. That sounds really novel, and I think of it as almost like something out of Alice in Wonderland, but it's not reality. And yeah, sometimes the ignorance can be cute if you have enough confidence. And that is the thing that I feel like is a personal victory, that I understand enough about my own experience and feel comfortable enough talking about it, that I rarely find times where I don't think it's appropriate now. And if somebody in a room of 10 people, if one of them has a problem with it, I can just feel like, oh, you've got stuff to work through, rather than that being some kind of threat to me, some kind of existential threat that I'm a wrong-un and I've shown myself, and something's terrible is going to be kicked out of humanity.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? Because we need communal bonds, right? That's humans. We don't have claws or fangs or anything like that to protect us. We rely on being part of the tribe. So that's the biggest fear, isn't it? Being kicked out. And like, you must seem normal and able, otherwise they might kick us out of the cave.
Yeah, the battle goes on, but I'm so glad.
Carry on, I can talk for hours, and it's like, wrap it up.
No, I've enjoyed talking to you so much, thank you. And so if people want to hear more of you via your carefully filtered writing, post red or any other colour marks, could you tell us about the book?
Sure. So the book is called Fuck, I Think I'm Dying, How I Learned to Live with Panic Attacks. It details my journey with panic. You know, it's not self-helpy. I mean, there's certainly full of things that I've learned throughout the years, but it's more a narrative about a lot of mistakes that I made, a lot of funny things that happened, some devastating things that have happened, and how I ultimately learned to live with it, and how panic attacks don't impact my life any more than, say, a bout of eczema would, or IBS. And I think that's really important. And it's out on the 6th of May.
Love it. And that is such power, that these symptoms are continuing for you and yet you found a way to minimise them. And I think that's a version of recovery that definitely doesn't get talked about enough. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Good. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.